You are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Friday, June 23rd, 2017. My name is Michael Brooks on a Michael Casual Friday, and this is the four-time award-winning Majority Report. We're broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On today's program, journalist, analyst, author Corey Pine. We're talking about the Senate's health care plan, Republicans moving in to destroy your health care to fund their tax giveaway, and the next phase of late-stage capitalism and top-down class warfare. Matt Christman from Chapo Trap House, Kushbaum, drops by to talk about sewer socialism, end of capitalism, and to give us a movie recommendation. Plus, Jimmy Kimmel calls out the GOP for not passing the Jimmy Kimmel test that he outlined for pre-existing conditions. Activists in wheelchairs forcibly removed as they protest outside of Mitch McConnell's office. Wendell Potter says that even his old buddies in the healthcare industry couldn't have designed a piece of legislation quite this evil. But Republicans certainly can. The centrists, very shrewd, Edward Luce of the Financial Times, breaks down the numbers and he says the only alternative we have right now to Trumpism is Sandersism and Corbynism. And he explains why Macron's ascent is not really all it's cracked up to be. Plus, Saudi's new heir-to-be, the Crown Prince, 31-year-old Crown Prince, major part of that country's horrific war crimes and war in Yemen, and someone who wants to potentially team with Israel to further isolate Iran, as Iran's former foreign minister warns that if the U.S. keeps undermining it, the Iran deal will unravel. I guess we can destroy Obama's prime domestic legacy. Let's throw in his prime international legacy as well, while doubling down on all of the mistakes he made nationally and internationally. All that and more on today's Majority Report. Sam, as I said, family medical issue. He, Nikki, and his children are totally fine. And obviously we'll keep you posted. So let's get to this sound. Jimmy Kimmel, about a month or so ago, called out the Republicans for passing legislation in the House that would drop protections for people pre-existing conditions. The Senate version of the Republican health care plan also does not provide protections for people pre-existing conditions. At the time, we praised Jimmy Kimmel for intervening, but we also did criticize him for saying that this is something we all support. The reality is that Republicans don't support that. Republicans do not support protecting people pre-existing conditions. They don't support expanding health care. And they don't really support anything, obviously, that can intervene with tax giveaways. And Jimmy Kimmel has seen the legislation, and he's come back to us to explain why it has not passed his test.
Good morning. Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell showed us a draft of his top secret new health care legislation. They opened the vault, they laid the bill out on a table, rubbed lemon juice all over it, and the text magically appeared for all to see. And wouldn't you know it, the bill includes a big tax cut for rich people. So unless you just got drafted by an NBA team, it's not great news. They're calling the plan Better Care, as in, just imagine how much better this plan would be if the people who wrote it cared. And it slashes Medicaid, which could negatively affect millions of poor and elderly people. But here's the thing. It won't happen until 2024. It's gradual, which makes you wonder why 2024. What is the significance of that? Will we all be in those pods from the Matrix by then? We won't need health care? No, the reason it's 2024 is because that will be after most of the current senators have run for re-election. And then these guys wonder why we hate them, and that's why.
That's exactly right. And also, they won, and also they should be hated. They should be held with complete contempt and disgust. Democrats seem to be getting a bit more aggressive on this, but until they pull out all the stops, there's a part of me that's concerned that they almost, some of them almost just view it as a something to run on in 2018 and not the clear and present danger to America that it is. I'll be talking about this with Corey Pine. Good for Jimmy Kimmel. Great work there. The only thing I would say is, I mean, it's not a May thing with putting people's lives at risk if we cut Medicaid. It will. It will absolutely affect and hurt millions of people. But interesting to see him. I mean, I never really thought of Jimmy Kimmel as a political guy, particularly one way or another. So it's very interesting to see him jump out like this.
That's why people hate them is a good thing for a. I'm happy to hear that from a late night host.
Absolutely, and I affirm that hatred. Something I don't hate at all. Something that we all love: Omaha Steaks. Upgrade your summer cookouts with gourmet Omaha Steaks. Everybody in this office has had everything. We've tried their burgers. We've tried their fries. We've even tried their apple tartlets. Sam usually snags the best for himself and sneaks off with it. But we've all had a little bit of crumbs that he has trickled down to us. But everything that they've had is, I mean, it just is really delicious. And right now, for a limited time, you can get an exclusive savings of 80% on a very special combo summer sensation, which includes two filet mignons, two sirloins, four boneless pork chops, four chicken fried steaks, 12 all beef meatballs, four Omaha steak burgers, four gourmet jumbo franks, 16 Omaha Steakhouse fries, four caramel apple tartlets, and a seasoning packet, plus four more Omaha steak burgers. Just for my listeners, this exclusive package is only $49.99. Go to omahasteaks.com, type report in the search bar, add the summer sensation to your cart. Again, visit omahasteaks.com, enter code report in the search bar to get this great package for $49.99. Have the best summer ever with Omaha Steaks. I did. They're great. I have had their burgers and their fries. I haven't had their steaks yet and other things. I haven't had the sirloin. That's what I really want to try.
Because Sam takes it all.
That's what I said. Sam snags all the good stuff. But it's amazing. Deals up on our website. We'll be right back with Corey Pine.
Kill me your bread. Yes, I. And we say, Jah over evil, life over death. Demon can't kill me again. We say, good over evil, life over death. Satan can't kill me. Here comes the hot stepper. Fire burning hotter than paper. That song you written proper than later. Protected from the crown of my head. Straight down to the very soul of the crepe, yeah. Me have a chat for them. Them send gunshot poison to your accident. Long time them a try like half my oxygen. But you're in control. Can't take me soul. Jah over evil. Life over death. Demon can't kill me again. Good over evil, life over death. Demon can't kill me. Them put
poison in a liquor, try curse me. A good thing, me no drink, me no thirsty. From the day my mother birth me, Selassie, I purge me, nobody can hurt me. Them disguise Jezebel in a the biggest way. Send her come to give me the biggest A. Can it left her in dismay? A long time, them a tie up until this day. Me say, good over evil, life over.
Welcome back to the Majority Report. Joining us now is Corey Pine. He's a journalist, writer for The Baffler, many other publications, and host of the News from Nowhere podcast, which I was just on again with you the other day. I had a great time, as always, Corey.
Hey, Mike. Good to have you on, and thanks for having me back.
Oh, it's my pleasure. So what isn't my pleasure? You know, Corey, we need to start figuring out, at least sometimes, even when we're just like talking on the phone or something, more pleasant things to talk about. But here we are. The Senate yesterday revealed the expected moral and policy monstrosity of their version of the healthcare destruction bill. I'm just going to go over, this is a very basic primer in Huffington Post. And again, it's very odd for people like you and I who recognize the problems with the ACA from a progressive perspective and recognize that obviously ultimately we need to have some version of Medicare for all if we really want to deal with these things. But this is where we are. So this is just a point-by-point comparison. And this is the ACA, the House bill, and the Senate bill. The Affordable Care Act. Most people are required to have insurance. Those without insurance pay a penalty. That's a problematic area, but was necessary for the way the coverage was designed. House bill. No coverage mandate, but it allows insurers to charge a 30% markup to people who enroll in a new plan after letting their coverage lapse for more than 2 months. Senate bill. No coverage mandate. ACA. Large employers face penalty if they don't offer employees health insurance. Makes a lot of sense. House bill. Eliminates employee mandate. Senate bill. Eliminates employee mandate. ACA, tax credits for people buying insurance are based on age, income, and cost of insurance. House bill, tax credits would vary by age, but otherwise be fixed, effectively helping some healthier and younger. Senate, tax credits would vary by income at a lower eligibility level than the ACA tax credits, which is important because they're also still an incredible tack on poor people, but they are going to, that's easier to spin. Just a few more, Corey. I just want to get through three more. Age-based pricing. ACA limits how much insurers can charge older people to 3 times what younger customers pay. Houseville, insurers can charge older consumers up to 5 times what they charge younger people, leading to higher costs for older people and lower costs for younger, we know. Senate version, insurers can charge older consumers up to 5 times, same as the House. Pre-existing, insurers, this is the ACA, insurers cannot deny coverage for pre-existing conditions or charge higher rates on patients' health or medical histories. House, allow states to let insurers opt out of covering people with pre-existing conditions. Provides fundings for states to set up high-risk pools and other mechanisms, which is fraudulent. Senate version, insurers cannot deny coverage due to they changed it, but there isn't muscularity to that enforcement mechanism. So basically everybody who's looked at it says that they changed the wording, but they don't actually have enforcement to sort of ensure that people are protected. And then finally, Medicaid. States expand Medicaid eligibility to healthy adults. This is an Obamacare. House ends the expansion, and the Senate version ends the expansion, and there would be less federal funding overall. The Senate version actually cuts Medicaid deeper than the House bill. So that's what we have here. Even after all of the backlash and all of the protests that happened over the last several months, the enormous unpopularity of the bill, what does that tell you about where we are and, you know, really the nature of Republican politics right now?
It's like they're trying to kill us. I can't remember a time when the government was trying to kill so many white people. Like, these are Republican voters. You know, it's really aggressive strategy. And I also remember when I remember when people said when the House passed its bill, don't worry, this won't make it through the Senate. Right. And now the Senate is considering essentially a crueler version of the same bill. Right. And this time, you know, there aren't going to be like weeks of angry town halls where Republicans have to go back and face their constituents. You know, I've said elsewhere, I don't think they really care how unpopular this plan is. Right. There's a big payday for the Republicans' donor base here, and they don't care how many people are going to die.
Right. I mean, and they can't. And the point is that the next phase of the strategy here is they want to do another round of enormous tax giveaways for the wealthy, and they want them to be permanent. They need to be revenue neutral tax giveaways. So cutting the social safety net is the one-to-one relationship to those tax giveaways. That's really why this has to happen, regardless of its popularity level.
It's even more brazen than that. I mean, you know, Kai Ryssdal, the NPR guy, he put something out on Twitter this morning. There's a provision in the Senate bill that is removing the cap for insurance companies to claim a tax break on right. their executive pay
right.
over $500,000. Apparently that was in the House bill, got taken out, and is now back in the Senate bill. I mean, what does that say about their priorities? You know, like, this is not a health care bill. I think even Obama said something like that.
He said, no, Obama, like, President Obama actually did say specifically on, he put a Facebook note out, which, you know, I guess isn't terribly surprising because this is, you know, his signature piece of domestic legislation. And really, as I said the other day on the show, I mean, it's the pinnacle of third way policy, frankly, whether it succeeds or fails in some respects. And, you know, but he said it, and he said it quite rightly. He said it was a massive wealth transfer. He said he did say that.
And my understanding is it's unless, you know, a few Republicans get peeled off in the Senate, it's pretty much a fait accompli because
right.
One of, I guess, Harry Reid's former chief of staff was saying on Twitter also this morning that, you know, the House will likely, if the Senate passes it, the House will pass it with no changes. There's no need for a conference report. It'll just sail through.
Right.
So, you know, I'm not even sure that, like, unlike the House bill, I'm not sure the public is aware that this is happening right now. Like, it just hasn't gotten the same coverage. So, you know, you could see people kind of coming to in a month or so and realizing like, oh, shit, like I don't have health care. I mean, that's basically where I'm at. I just moved back to the U.S.
Right.
And like a lot of these provisions like directly target me. I mean, they basically make it so I'm not probably going to get health insurance this year,
right.
especially with the Medicaid cuts here in Oregon. I mean, the state is they use the Medicaid, expanded Medicaid to fund a pretty generous state health program, insurance program.
Right.
And I can only imagine what's going to happen to that if this bill passes.
And just to be clear, because I don't think I was clear before briefly on the pre-existing conditions provision, the House got rid of it entirely or basically just let states set their own sort of provisions, this kind of race to the bottom, which we also see even with employee health insurance, right? That's the other kind of aspect that's coming out of this, that if employers can kind of search around the country for the lowest standards, that will affect you even if you have kind of corporate insurance. But the Senate version basically reinstitutes some language around protecting people with pre-existing conditions, but still allows states to fiddle around with what that actually means. So under the ACA, we have a national uniform standard of if you have a pre-existing health problem, you're going to get insurance. In both versions, that's undermined and jeopardized. And I know, and I get, I mean, yes, I know, of course, a lot of people across the spectrum who will either immediately lose their insurance or the price of their care will spike significantly. I think, you know, I guess what I want to sort of look at, you know, I mean, there's different ways of looking at the sort of bigger picture of this, but I think that isn't this just the kind of logical endpoint of modern Republican politics, which is that the irony that basically you had Donald Trump win the presidency through this fusion that we've never seen in modern electoral politics, which was that he did this, you know, fake pseudo-populism. He actually acknowledged people's very real and very sincere and proper economic concerns. He promised that everybody would have, you know, if you listen to his rhetoric on Obamacare during the campaign, it was clear that, well, A, he had no idea what he was talking about, but B, if you were sucked into his con, he was actually attacking Obamacare from the left. He was attacking premium rises and saying everybody's going to get insurance and nobody's going to be on the street to die. And he wasn't going to cut Social Security or Medicare. So on one hand, you have a guy, and then, of course, you know, overt racism, misogyny, and bigotry. So that fusion gets him into the White House: conspiracy theories, con man populism, and bigotry. That's the sort of last vestige and effective message of how to sell right-wing populist politics. And then the policy set that we're seeing now is that we've even gone past the point of even like a sort of pretending from Republican leadership or a kind of like even some notion, as you said, of like racialized distribution or deserving versus undeserving poor. Now it's like, hey, we got to give the Koch brothers couch change a tax cut. And if that means you die, tough. And it's also, I mean, the last thing I want to put into the mix and, you know, respond to all of it is that to me, it doesn't seem all that, you know, incidental that we saw a wave in February of Republican state legislators basically pushing through legislation to criminalize protest at the very same time that they're, you know, escalating this unprecedented assault on people's well-being.
I think the bigger picture is not just that this is the logical endpoint of Republican Party politics, but interrogate that a little further. What does that mean? I mean, you look around at all the crises we're facing in the globe, and certainly in the U.S., like the provision of health care is something that is a crisis. It's a constructed crisis because of the way we distribute wealth in this society. But the bigger picture is elites around the globe are pulling up the drawbridge, and this is how that manifests here in America. You know, what do they need? You mentioned the Koch brothers. I mean, what do they need this like extra money for? They're so rich. I mean, and all the Republicans that they're essentially have bought over the last 20, 30 years, like, what do they need this money for? They need it for, you know, gated communities and private security forces to keep the rabble out. That like, and at the same time you see, you know, what's his name? Rick Perry, you know, basically denying official energy secretary climate denier position, right? Like, but it's real. Like, they can't change the fact that it's real, right?
Right.
So I think what we're saying is essentially like capital shoring up its position for crises they know are coming. I mean, I'm not trying to sound like a doomer here, but how else are we supposed to interpret this? I mean,
politics
has become about survival. Like, it's very like politics is very much about survival now for millions and millions of people in what, you know, for now is still a wealthy industrial country. Anyway, go ahead. What were you going to say?
No, I think you're right. I mean, I know both you and I have read and talked about the Cameroonian post-colonial philosopher Achille Mbembe, and he has that essay that came out in 2016 called The End of the Age of Humanism. And that was the point, was that basically, like, anything that was ameliorating or slowing this sort of raw energy of capital acquisition and sort of all of the social and environmental devastation caused by that, whether those things were cultural traditions or cultural norms or, you know, economies and governance that were, you know, designed in some ways to kind of, you know, take the benefits of capital and offset the damages, that's being eaten and stripped away completely across the board. So we can start looking, you know, we used to have this myth that Well, if you make the right decisions and you do the right things, if you're in a, you know, a developing country, you can be wealthy and become more like us. Well, when we look at the future map of the world today with what we're doing to social safety nets and what we're doing with austerity and what we're doing with starving the public sector and creating mass inequality in Western societies, is that what you're basically showing is like, no, you're actually, you know, we're going to look like India in the 1970s, except with, you know, cool cell phones.
I think that that's pretty spot on. I mean, I read that essay as well. You mentioned the endpoint. I'm always constantly reminding people that it can get worse. As you know, every day, every week, there's new outrages from the Trump administration, and people seem to think that this will be the thing that causes him to get impeached, or that
right.
that causes Republicans to regain their sense of decency. But I'm constantly reminding people that the end is the bottom is a lot lower than you think it is. You know, there's places in this world where the ruling elites talk amongst themselves about, you know, keeping the ungovernable masses fed just enough to keep them from revolting. I mean, that has been a viable way of organizing societies for hundreds and hundreds of years. And there's no reason that just because we've had a good run the last 60 to 100 years or so here in the U.S., that our elites are any less rapacious than that. I mean, look at Paul Ryan, like right. who's basically running the country right now. He's an Ayn Rand asshole.
Yes.
And what is that? Like, everybody knows what this philosophy is about. I mean, it's about looking at people as human lives as being worth only what their economic output is. And, you know, neoliberal capitalism has created this situation where you've got a lot of surplus people that aren't producing a lot, and people like Paul Ryan see them as a drain. So, you know, ultimately, it's like, from their point of view, who cares if people die,
right?
You know, because they don't have insurance, they're not productive. I mean, it's social Darwinism for the 21st century. And
yes,
yeah,
no, that's exactly what it is. And I think, you know, this is the kind of conversation that I think to me really starts to contextualize the debate inside, if we can kind of go back, you know, we just took a global, now we'll reshrink it. This debate inside the Democratic Party, but also, frankly, just inside any type of party politics in democracies globally. What is the relationship between movements of resistance against the stage of capital we're in? What is the role of electoral politics? I think some people reject electoral politics, which I think is, you know, foolish. It's still a very important platform for exercising power, obviously. And then we have, you know, these debates that we get into in this kind of like YouTube universe where, you know, people will accuse someone like me or Sam of being like moderate sellouts because we don't support some like silly, you know, accelerationist personal kind of moral fulfillment voting strategy. And we recognize the difference that, especially in a time of crisis, that there is a pretty radical difference between, you know, toxic, destructive, failed, exhausted Clinton bullshit versus, you know, rapacious, neo-fascistic, like, you know, pedal to the metal earth destruction. So that said, it does seem to me that at this point that we have, you know, the hope of the kind of global technocratic center is in France right now. And there's this notion that maybe, you know, Macron can sort of magically reduplicate the 90s formula of kind of limited social safety nets, liberalized capital and labor markets, and now social liberalism. It actually wasn't social liberalism in the 90s. But Edward Luce, of all people, writing in the Financial Times, was like, look, Macron's turnout in parliamentary elections where he won big, the turnout was incredibly low. And his win was, sure, some of it was his youth, some of it was being new on the scene, but it was the same way that Chirac won in 2002. French voters, thankfully, still really don't want a fascist president. But where is their energy? Jeremy Corbyn had a youth surge. What Bernie Sanders did in the Democratic Party. And then you go take the smaller example. I mean, John Ossoff couldn't even pull off the Georgia upset. It starts to mean that, like, this little debate relative to what we were talking about before in the Democratic Party, it is relevant to these global dimensions because we at least need to begin to start answering these questions instead of ignoring them completely or thinking that a formula that worked in a very specific historical moment in the 90s can keep being replicated.
Well, you guys covered Super Mario in Wisconsin, right? I mean, he's sort of he's kind of being portrayed as the anti-Ossoff, or at least like the Bernie Wing test case to take Paul Ryan on directly. I don't know about the odds in that district versus what Ossoff was looking at in Georgia, but it'll be interesting to see how that plays out. His name is Randy Bryce. I should not just call him Super Mario because he looks like Super Mario, but he totally does. anyway, you know, what I was talking about how politics is becoming a fight for survival, that ad that he ran that got so much attention was about exactly that issue. So I can't imagine that it would connect any worse than Ossoff's message on healthcare, which was that it needed to be more affordable. And, you know, even loyal Democrats could see through the sort of I don't know, Ken doll aspect of Ossoff. I mean, you know, Will Bunch in the Philly Daily News had a pretty good line about him. He said of Ossoff, "I listened to an interview he did on NPR on Tuesday morning, and by the end, I practically wanted to gouge my eyes out. It was some of the most insipid, focus group tested, and consultant approved, meaningless happy talk I've ever heard from a Democrat," which is saying a lot.
Yeah, that's extraordinary. That's like what their primary rhetorical tactic is, right?
Yeah, and in Current Affairs, Nathan Robinson said that one good reason why Tom Price beat his last opponent by 23 points was that his last opponent was functionally indistinguishable from a corpse or a bag of lettuce. anyway, the point is there's a reason that these kinds of Macron, Ossoff, even Trudeau up in Canada.
Oh, certainly Trudeau up in Canada. Great mediocrity. Yeah.
And Obama was the archetype, right? I mean, sort of a charismatic vessel for, you know, liberal-minded, pseudo-progressive tweaks to the existing order. But, you know, the people that are both the candidates and the people that are backing these kind of candidates, I think a huge part of the problem is they're because of how great inequality is in our society, they're detached from the reality that people are increasingly living through of not having health insurance, of not having secure employment. And, you know, these are the boomers who don't understand why they're, you know, like 30-something millennial kids, like, can't find a job and still need to borrow money to make the rent or whatever. Like,
it's like, you know, when I was your age, I went to debt-free college, got a professional degree, had lifelong secured employment, and made a lot of money. You're super entitled.
Yeah. Yes. Well, people with that outlook are the ones making, you know, the political decisions in the Democratic Party. You still don't – there's a generation gap. There's an income gap. And I just don't think – because of whatever class issues are at play, that the decision makers and the Democrats are quite getting it yet. Now, maybe they're starting to, but I think, you know, the reality is we need new decision makers, not to wait around for them to get it. I mean, ultimately, you know, the class interest of the Wall Street Democrats, third way Democrats will override whatever you know, self-preservation instincts they have as far as electoral politics go. They'll always go for the Macron, the Ossoff, Trudeau type politician.
Right. That's exactly right. I mean, one area as we move towards closing, but I always want to get your perspective. You have a book that is forthcoming on kind of Silicon Valley madness. And one of the things that has been interesting about the Trump era was, you know, I think there was a lot of understanding with the second term of Obama and if we got Clinton that we were going to need to start having a very serious conversation about, you know, tech monopolies, the role of Silicon Valley's fantasies and inequality, and how do we actually start kind of governing these commons? How do we create 21st century, you know, anti-monopoly movement, consumer bill of rights in the tech environment? under Trump, you know, in some ways, you know, I mean, even things that are extremely important, obviously, have kind of, you know, it's hard to think about, you know, Facebook exploiting its users when, like, you know, pesticides that got banned in the 80s are getting, like, reintroduced into the gene pool. Right. And, you know, this sort of, like, unbelievable just kind of, like, orgy of destruction that the Republicans are unleashing. But it has, you know, what I think it has done, though, with Silicon Valley specifically is basically kind of shown that they don't even necessarily draw the line just with the sort of, like, friendly corporate Democrats. A lot of them are willing to play ball even with Trump. Some of them, you know, left his advisory thing after Paris, but a lot of them are still showing up. And of course, it put the light on people like Peter Thiel and, you know, the kind of neo-fascist strain.
Yeah, I honestly am not that surprised that some of these Silicon Valley CEOs, including, like, the most recently, I think the Google leaders were sitting at the table with Trump and praising his leadership. These companies are defense contractors.
It's Google.
People lose.
Google. They said I did a great job, and they know. Isn't the computers? They're unbelievable.
First result when you search Donald Trump is Donald Trump, so they must be doing something right.
Did you see that? It's the first result. It's amazing.
These companies are defense contractors, and for the most part, they have been for decades.
Explain that to people. So, that's interesting. Explain that.
Well, look, I mean, the internet was a defense research project, you know, beginning in the 60s and culminating in the late 80s and 90s. Some of the inventors eventually went on very quickly. Well, let me step back a little bit. Once the military essentially funded an academic network that became the internet,
right.
The people that were in charge of the research immediately started lobbying Clinton and Gore, essentially, to privatize the internet, and then went and joined the private sector, made a pile of money, started funding new companies, and those companies, not just Microsoft and Google, but most of the big players in Silicon Valley, Amazon, for instance, have Oracle was first investor was the CIA. I mean, the defense establishment has always been very close to Silicon Valley because, you know, the original reason we needed all these computers was to aim rockets.
Right.
This continues on to the present day through Obama, and the thread line with the Trump administration is the cyber war push. You know, that's a huge payout for Silicon Valley in the form of defense contracts. So, you know, these companies can't afford to be too anti-Trump, even if they personally think he's a moron,
right.
Which I have no doubt that they do. Even Peter Thiel. I think he sees Trump, much like Steve Bannon sees Trump, as a useful tool.
Not the brightest guy in the world. I'll admit that myself. Anyways, but he's going to expedite my ability to run over children from Honduras and take their blood. So well, pragmatism calls.
And our friend Peter Thiel, I mean, Palantir, his company, is building, if I remember correctly, the databases, surveillance databases for the soon-to-come state terror campaign against Muslims, or arguably in-progress terror campaign against
Muslims.
Well,
also has stands to benefit from every measure targeting immigrants as well.
Right.
I mean, and this is a guy who brands himself as a libertarian. Meanwhile, is it like the whole business model is? Yeah. I mean, I do want to say, just you reminding us of the Clintons' record in that. I feel like the next tech council meeting, Trump needs to get up and say, "And we finally need to privatize the internet. Government needs to unshackle the private market online." I mean, it's true.
I can only imagine what he would think that would look like, you know, because basically, like, Twitter, I've wondered how much money Twitter makes just from having Trump on their platform.
Trump has saved Twitter as a company. I mean, like, legitimately, arguably, yes. I mean, he is, to use the parlance of the age, Trump is a great content creator.
And that
content is the destruction of everything.
When Trump was tweeting about North Korea and like how the negotiations with China haven't worked out, you know, every time he does something like that, I think, God, is this tweet going to be the last thing we ever see?
Right.
You know, like, it's like Twitter clearly has a responsibility of some sort to I don't know.
Unilaterally have other heads of state block him or something. What I actually like is I like when he actually sometimes like he discovers something like there's two like sometimes he either discovers something accidentally that's like not a problem like because a while ago he was just like, you know, China's got a lot to say about this whole North Korea thing. Maybe they should take care of it. And you're like, oh, whoa, okay. That is like basically U.S. foreign policy. All right, fair enough. I mean, they could sit down, have a bowl of rice, and figure it out. And then the other time, when he, because of something disgusting, gets less disgusting on something else, like now because he loves the Saudis so much, he's slightly less offensive about Muslims because he has, like, Saudi buddies who, like, share interior decorators with him. He's just like, wait a second, Muslims can't be all bad. I mean, these guys, they're great. They behead people. Imagine what I could do to the failing New York Times.
Somebody should just go into the Oval Office with a laser pointer and like lead him around like a kitten.
I could see that.
His attention span is about that length. But I, you know, to circle back to what we're talking about, any hope that these, you know, tech companies, that there's some kind of like West Coast counterbalance to Wall Street, right, or you know, the big oil majors to be found in Silicon Valley, it's delusional. I mean, these companies, right, are as greedy and as uncaring toward what happens to the masses of people on this planet as, you know, the oil companies or Goldman Sachs or any of them. So, you know, I really do fear that the Democrats would, you know, that this insurgent push inside the Democratic Party fails. Why wouldn't we see Zuckerberg running on the Democratic ticket? I mean, right, these people, you know, they brought Mike Bloomberg to their national convention last summer.
Yes, they brought the same people that and yes, they brought Mike Bloomberg, great plutocrat and promoter of racial profiling, to go and insult Trump for not actually being rich. Brilliant. All right, Corey Pine, my friend, it's always great to be talking with you, man. I appreciate it as always, and I'll be talking with you soon. Everybody should check Corey out, News from Nowhere podcast on Twitter. We have links to all your stuff on the website. Thanks a lot, Corey, as always.
Yeah. Take it easy, people.
Be well. All right, everybody, we're going to take a brief break, and we will be back with Matt Crispin from Chapo Trap House. He's going to give us a movie recommendation. He's going to talk to us about sewer socialism on the Majority Report. Biggie.
This goes out to Biggie. You. Biggie. This goes out to you and you and you. Biggie. You. Biggie. This goes out to you. This goes out to Biggie. You. Biggie. This goes out to you and you. Your reign on the top was short like leprechauns as I crush so-called willies, thugs, and rapadons. Get in that quick fast like Ramadan. It's that rap phenomenon, Don Dada, Papa. You got to call me Francis M.H. White intake like toast, tote iron. Was told in shootouts, stay low and keep firing. Keep extra clips for extra Who's next to flip on that cat with that grip on rap? The most shady, Frankie baby. Ain't no telling where I may be. May see me in D.C. at Howard Homecoming with my man Capone Dumbin. Something you should know, my steelo went from 10 G's for blow to 30 G's a show to I never seen before. So Jesus, get off the notorious before I squeeze them bucks. If the beef between us, we can settle it with the chrome and metal sh- I make it hot like a kettle get. You're delicate, you better get who sent you. You still pedal sh- I got more rides, the great adventure.
Biggie, how are you gonna do it? Do it.
Kick in the door, wave in the 4-4. All you heard was Papa, don't hit me no more. Kick in the door, wave in the 4-4. All you heard was Papa, don't hit me no more.
chick in the door, waving the 4-4. All you heard was Papa, don't hit me no more. Chick in the door, waving the 4-4. All you heard was Papa, don't hit me no more. On your mark, get set. When I spark, you're wet. Look how dark you get when you're marked for death. Should I start your breath or should I let you die? In fear, you start to cry. Ask why. Lyrically, I'm worship. Don't front the word sick. You cursed it.
Welcome back to the Majority Report. I'm Michael Brooks. Joining us now, Matt Chrisman of Chapo Trap House. Very shrewd, funny guy. Matt, how you doing?
I'm good. How are you?
Well, I was telling you, I mean, I don't know. I'm on some level, I'm sort of like today, Matt and I, before the show and probably in the second half, we were developing a new like Mitch McConnell triad character. Like there's something entertaining and amusing about how disgusting everything is, but at the same time, if you slow it down, I mean, it's really, really terrible. So, yeah. How are you?
Yeah, it's one of those things where you can't really look at it directly. You kind of need a camera obscura of irony to process what you're seeing, or else your brain would melt.
You need to, if you're like me, take a vacation, take a run, and then do a bunch of Maoist Bernie impressions where he praises the guy who shot Steve Scalise, you know? That's kind of what you need to do.
My only criticism is that he did not use a spread weapon such as a shotgun, which would have done a more effective job of hitting targets without aiming.
All right, Matt, you and I haven't talked before, but clearly we're going to become friends. I would just like to say that although capitalist lackey Steve Scalise has survived, that we praise our comrade. And look, these things take a long time. Revolutions don't happen overnight. I've been telling people. Good luck. Hey, Steve, I missed you at softball practice. Where were you, buddy?
Something. By the way, you went out of the baseline. That means that you are out, I'm afraid.
Oh, God. See? That helps everybody. So what's Steve Scalise? That's what you need. It's a comedy routine, Kelly. It's not serious. Yeah. We're not actually advocating this.
No, we would never advocate
something like this.
Never make light of David Duke without the baggage catching a bullet. Never. I would never joke about that.
Never. And by the way, I would never, ever, 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 ever. Yeah, what Matt said. I was gearing up for that. A guy who bragged about being David Duke without the baggage. Exactly.
Yeah. It'd be awful. Would never make fun of that.
Never. You know what was amazing was that I would never, as an example, say that the only thing coming out of the new draft of the healthcare bill that I like is that it might implicate Steve Scalise's future ability to get coverage. I would never make a joke like that.
if he ended up like, you know, he's got to get like his pins and his hip replaced or something, and they're like, sorry, not covered anymore. I'd hope that he would be able to be like, fair enough.
You know what would be great though is that like Ryan would just be like, sorry, Steve, you're not in the team anymore. I think you know how this ends. And Birdie.
Let's go. You know what? Enough of the baseball. Let's go fishing. I'll take you out on a boat.
Hey, Steve, you want to teach my son how to go fishing? Oh, sorry. He's at his Hebrew school. Why don't you go out with one of my campaign aides? All right, send your tweets our way, and Kelly is not implicated in any of those jokes. No, I wish Steve Scalise a speedy recovery. What happened was terrible, but I also think that what we choose to focus on is a political choice in and of itself, and I'm just not going to pretend that a deranged person who beat his wife, who obviously did something violent and stupid and destructive, I mean, yeah, it's terrible. And if there's any policy upshot, it would be gun control that all those people oppose. And every day, I mean, you know, I don't care about Bill Clinton either, but Jesse Helms said in the 1990s that, like, if Bill Clinton visited North Carolina, he should wear a bulletproof vest. You know, I mean,
I remember.
I mean, that's unbelievable, man.
Yeah. Well, you know, I mean.
My point being that if Steve Scalise comes to Brooklyn, he should wear a bulletproof vest. Sorry. Call back. All right.
He should dress up like 50 Cent when he used to wear that the bulletproof vest and the rag.
You know what? If Steve Scalise worked a 50 line into his comeback speech on the floor of the house, like he's like, I took a few, but I'm all right. My approval rating for him would spike. That's like 50's coolest line for sure. Okay. Now, on a very different end of the spectrum, Matt, you, what I like about you is that you're somebody who has a very keen sense of, for lack of a better word, kind of like, it shouldn't be, but really underground American history. When we talk about radicalism, a lot of us look across, you know, we look at politicians or theorists in Africa or Europe or wherever, and that's, or Asia, that's relevant, that's important. But there is this long American infrastructure and history of radical and at the very least democratic socialist politics. And that's something that I feel like you have a very keen sense of, and you weave into a lot of your assessments of things. You've been talking about this sort of sewer socialism idea, kind of pothole socialism, and the kind of American roots of that. And I know that you did it on a premium episode of your show of Chapo. So you, maybe you don't want to give away the store because you have a product to market, but give us a sense of it and how it kind of fits with today's moment.
Yeah. So what I talk about in the episode is what later, it wasn't known at the time as that. It was called it later, sort of pejoratively actually by other socialists in the 30s, a more radical socialist, as quote, sewer socialism, which was municipal socialists who took control of the city of Milwaukee, which is in my home state of Wisconsin, in the 1910s and 20s. In 1910, the Socialist Party, which was had just been founded less than a decade earlier, elected the mayor, the majority of the city council, and one of the members of the House of Representatives from Milwaukee. And there was a wave of socialist municipal leadership across the country during those decades, but Milwaukee saw the most prolonged period and the most concentrated power of socialists in any American city. And what they did, the reason they got called the sewer socialists is because they were less focused on ideological battles and more focused on providing people with reliable, effective, corruption-free municipal infrastructure and services. Mm-hmm. They nationalized they made public the sewer system and transportation systems, made them more efficient, made them run better, and basically gave people that experience. And the idea was in sort of the revisionist Marxist tradition that had been generated in Germany in the previous decade and was being taken up by these guys, was to give people an example of what voting for socialism would give you. And it had it was successful. They had the second socialist mayor of Milwaukee, Dan Hoehn, was mayor throughout the entire 20s. And then there was they had their last socialist mayor, Frank Seidler, was mayor all throughout the 50s during the era of the Red Scare. So
how did that happen?
They had a because it was
just
because
it was so effective.
Socialism.
Okay.
Right, because people voting for Seidler had a memory of the sewer socialists who had provided for people and given them, you know, this sort of this vision of competent public administration that people liked.
So at the risk of offending you, Matt, but just to contextualize it for people, they were progressives who got things done.
That's exactly what they were. Yeah.
Right.
And it is kind of funny. And parenthetically, I forgot to mention this on my show, but I got sidetracked. Is that when Victor Berger, who was the socialist who won the...
Also Vine filmmaker, yes.
Yeah, I don't know if they're related. It seems kind of crazy coincidental that they have the exact same name.
Yeah.
But Victor Berger was elected to the House of Representatives in 1910, that same year that they took over the city government. And his slogan his pitch to voters was drain the swamp.
Wow. That's unbelievable.
But, you know, he was, and this just kind of shows how like populist language is so flexible and malleable. And
right.
Because he was coming at from the idea of draining the swamp from a, you know, a rigorous sort of Marxist socialist
right.
analysis of power that said this is, these people are, you know, the handmaidens of capitalism and need to be brought under public control. And then you got a guy now, we can have a guy like Trump say it, and it's just like, it just means, it's just that we just, we're alienated from government, but we don't have any kind of coherent idea why. So any dipsh, you know, any ass like can show up with a giant, you know, cotton candy hair and tell you that, that the swamp needs to get drained. And because you saw him get tough with Meatloaf and Gary Busey on The Celebrity Apprentice, it's like, you know what? He's making sense.
That was, I have to say, that was one of Obama's, that was a great moment. I think it was whatever the year was where Trump was in the audience and he said something like, remember he said like, you've made like decisions like, you know, at Outback Steakhouse, like fire Little John or Gary Busey, but like really Meatloaf was the manager. So he had to go and he paused and he's just like, those kind of decisions will keep me up at night. That was beautiful.
Yeah, and everyone
it's also
died,
probably why Trump is president.
Like, well, but exactly. And they were like, well, that's the end of Trump. And they were like, oh, right. People are so violently alienated from politics and so disgusted by the concept of it that they don't care. And to them, getting tough with Meatloaf is a more real, tangible expression of leadership than anything anybody is doing in Washington.
Do you think that another thing, and I don't want to kind of totally open, you know, the full scale of the subject, but one of the things that I've been thinking about recently with this kind of, and I don't even think that this is a real debate in many ways in the sense of not outside of Twitter melodrama, but look, Twitter melodrama is obviously a part of our lives with the work that we do.
Certainly.
But this notion that there is this argument inside progressive politics that supposedly pits a radical economic analysis, whether it's, you know, fully Marxist or even just a genuine social democratic or even frankly genuinely progressive liberal position, right? Versus people who are who, you know, more sort of strongly identify with movements of social emancipation, and there's this sort of, you know, the back and forth, and that was, and a lot of this did start in this kind of Caldor version of intersectionality of like the Clinton campaign, which is, you know, well, you know, somehow we'll make nonsense up about Bernie to undermine Medicare for all. But in real life, there's no doubt, obviously, and I think, you know, both sides have their blind spots. I have heard people that you know, will focus on an economic analysis to the exclusion of everything else. I've seen that, and it is a problem. And I've obviously seen people that have no understanding of economic structure in their analysis, and obviously that's a problem. But one of the things that's been hitting me recently is, like, one of the problems with this frame, and this is a difference between let me just take 30 seconds to explain this to people so it doesn't get all, you know, fucking terminology based. But, like, I guess an intersectionality position would be that there's race, there's gender, and there's your economic position, and all of these things work together and affect your position. And that's true. I think it's very, of course, that's an accurate statement. But in a Marxist reading, your kind of class position and your economic position is almost like, it's not an identity in the same way your gender or your sexuality is an identity. It is a mechanical process of where you are in the economic structure. Your exploitation is distinct from your identity. And I just think that that's something that is so, and it reminded me of what you were saying about how terminology gets lost in America because we don't have a grounding in kind of certain basic rigor of radical understanding. That the even thinking of class as just another identity category misses that class and exploitation runs across all identities and all economic brackets because it's a function of a particular way of designing a market. Not like, oh, well, you drink beer and you listen to a certain kind of music, or whatever, so you have a class identity. It's an economic function.
Yeah, no, yeah. That's 100% accurate. And I would say that so much of these misunderstandings and so much of what leaves us adrift is the fact that we don't have this vocabulary. And more specifically, that like people forget this whole process of turning class into cultural markers, that was a right-wing project. That's like a 30-year project to say that your class has nothing to do with what you do for a living. It has nothing to do with, you know, whether you're selling your labor or whether you're extracting rents. It has to do with, yeah, whether you like pickup trucks or hybrids, or whether you like wine or beer, or whether you like country music or hip hop.
Right.
And that's not an accident that we think that way. This is part of like the broader sort of counter cultural propaganda campaign that was, you know, funded in the reaction and to the New Deal, and then more specifically when the Great Stagnation happened in the 70s and sort of the mass capital counterattack to sort of start, you know, scraping the few remaining crumbs of profit by cannibalizing workers' wages as opposed to expanding the economy, which is no longer really possible. And that, and like Reagan, you know, I mean, that these are all efforts. This is a project, and we're sort of living in the backwash of it. And this really is up to us to try to like reassert class as a thing separate from culture. And like you can see all these right wingers, like they really do embrace, they love the idea of all of this being culture war. We did an episode a few weeks ago where we just ran down all of the worst right wing websites and clickbait farm.
Right.
And one of the things we did is we did a sampling of all of their headlines, and every single one was about Last Man Standing getting canceled, or Lennart Dunham, or something like that. Like, they are totally all in on fighting on that terrain because they know it's to their advantage.
Right.
And when we fall in with that, we're playing along, and we're helping them.
Well, and also you're what's happening too is that whether or not it, you know, whoever wins or loses, and of course, like on the those battles do matter too, obviously, right? Like, of course, marriage equality versus not marriage equality is a vitally important thing. But the deeper assessment, I mean, there's two parts of what you're saying. One is that, which I think you're hitting on, which is really important, is that when we start talking about class and the way you're talking about it, actually just becomes another marketing category, which is like the kind of ultimate irony. And then the second thing is that if we were to take the obvious reality that part of systems of you know, structural oppression, of course, are, as an example, massively disproportionately focused on Black and Hispanic people with everything, private prisons and, you know, policing and everything else, there is no remotely serious strategy for dealing with that that doesn't at some point involve radical income redistribution. And again, because of just that kind of immovable class reality as a function and not just another category. So I think you do a really, really good job of showing that. I'm wondering, Matt, I know we only have a couple minutes left. This is like usually the movie pick segment, and usually this is where me and Sam and usually some kind of comedian probably make fun of Dennis Miller for like 15 minutes and then say like, oh, go watch something on Netflix. But in your case, you can give a movie pick, but also, I mean, I don't know, man, it could be a book pick, whatever you want. I'm just curious what's hitting you right now and what people should look up.
Well, I know everyone feels really frustrated, like, by living in this idiot hell world that we do, and surrounded by just the stupidest, most violently ignorant morons and
yes,
people who have just decided that they have no more social constraint on being as publicly malicious as they possibly can.
That's right.
You've got a Republican Party now that has decided that they don't need to ever contest an election again, barely, so they can do whatever they want.
Do you have Mitch McConnell's like looking at those people protesting in his office like, you can keep doing it and you'll get removed, but I'm literally getting hard watching you suffer.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's like, it's going to be really great when this bill passes and we just feed you into a giant rendering plant and turn you into animal feed.
You know, I do reserve, by the way, I reserve the right for even sharper cuts. And now that I see you out there in your wheelchairs, come to think of it, I wasn't going to announce this, but getting rid of the People with Disabilities Act is getting fast-tracked. So enjoy your protesting.
I can't wait till I can just stand up on the top of the Capitol building and just watch you all bounce around down at the base of the stairs and not be able to get up there. That's going to be real funny to me when that happens.
Y'all never took initiative by marrying into a family of Taiwanese drug smugglers. Maybe if you had, you'd be able to take care of your health care.
I'm going to celebrate the passage of this bill by creating a giant bonfire of amputated diabetes limbs.
But that said, I've actually talked to some people that I know in certain societies in Hong Kong and Taiwan, and fentanyl is going to be getting a lot stronger. So maybe an upside. So what should we look at? Because everything is so disgusting.
A movie that's a cathartic, fun time and is also a really brilliantly made thriller is Green Room.
Green Room. When did that come out?
Yeah, it came out last year, 2016.
Oh, that's new.
It's got Patrick Stewart. It's got...
It's really great.
Maybe from Arrested Development. Yes, it is.
It's really great, but you really have to like horror films, which I do.
Yeah, it's pretty gruesome.
Right.
Okay, it's gruesome.
I honestly saw it with my friend, and about 40 minutes in, he had to leave.
Right. Gone. That'll be some people's reaction, and people who like movies like that, it's one of the best ones I've ever seen. Real quick, Matt.
Yeah, no, it's one of my favorite movies of the last year.
All right, Green Room. You hear it. Yes, real quick, Kelly. Kelly has a question for you before you run, Matt.
Well, I have a listener request, and that is, do you do a Gorka impression?
Oh, you want Gorka off?
I don't do the Gorka on the show. That's James Adomian.
Oh, okay.
Adomian, another Jew.
Another Jew. Because of my flawless British accent. But that's separate.
No, but you know what? You know what? Do an Alex Jones, though, don't you?
That's right. I do Alex Jones. I do Alex Jones all if possible. Let me tell you about the horse, folks.
You know what?
Here's what you need to know about the horse.
What I wanted to do is I wanted to book Alex Jones's ex-wife, who's going, it's awesome. She's like going out and doing all these interviews and talking about how he's like the worst person ever. But what I wanted to do is get, because my Jones is okay, Sam's is good, yours is very good. But any of us, just for her to like call into a show and be like, listen, baby, I think about you every night. I need you back.
Father's rights are human rights, okay?
Father's rights are human rights, but I don't want to live life without you. I can't fight the globalists and expose what's happening in Sandy Hook without you by my side.
Look, all right, it's all irony. I admit it. I'm doing it for the little. Just come back for me, please.
Just leave it on the field. Leave it on the field. All right, Matt, this was a lot of fun. I hope to talk to you again soon, man. Thanks so much.
Yeah, absolutely. Bye-bye. Right,
take care, man. Bye. Wow.
It's interesting. I hadn't heard of sewer socialists before, but that movement seems very parallel to one in North Dakota around the same time.
Oh, really?
The Nonpartisan League, which was when the state bank was created, and there was like sort of state grain elevator. Like, there's a lot of Midwestern populism back then.
Prairie populism. Bear that in mind for stuff we're talking about. That's interesting. All right, everybody. Turning the IMs on. 646-257-3920. 646-257-3920. Become a member of the Majority Report today. Majority.fm/become a member. Subscribe to our YouTube channel. Subscribe to us on iTunes. Write us a review. Support Patreon to keep YouTube going. You know what it is. We'll see you on the fun half. I like that. That sounds like a much more fun transition song. We'll be right back.
nation's sad.